I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. It seems as if every time you turn on the news, there's a report of gun violence somewhere in our city. Last night, another shooting claimed the life of a 17-year-old boy and left a young girl in critical condition. Today, we'll ask members of the clergy about the role churches have in addressing the gun violence epidemic. They will offer thoughts on whether they and their congregants have a moral responsibility to address the policies and politics surrounding guns. Then councilman and pedestrian Eric Bunn struck a chord with his recent tweet about a dangerous encounter with a car and driver. You've probably experienced one yourself at some point. So we're asking, why is being a pedestrian such a risky venture? We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. With mass shootings rocking the nation and too many homicides rocking Kansas City, many are asking what more can be done to stem the violence. One answer may well be the church. For many Kansas Cityans living in violence-prone neighborhoods, it's the church that offers hope for a better road ahead. But what exactly should the church do? What's the role of the church when it comes to dealing with an issue that is difficult to solve, with causes that can range from a lack of well-paying jobs to a lack of education and even deadbeat parenting? Now a conversation about those very questions. With us, the Reverend Dr. Emmanuel Cleaver III is a senior pastor of St. James United Methodist Church here in Kansas City. Reverend, nice to have you. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
The Reverend Lori Anderson's also here. She's the minister of church, is the minister of church life at Rolling Hills Presbyterian Church out in Overland Park. Reverend, nice to have you too. Welcome.
Thank you.
Well, Reverend Cleaver, when it comes to dealing with violence in this town, I'm wondering, where does the church even begin?
It's a big task, and it will take the efforts of a lot of different groups. I think there are a few things that churches can do. One, I think churches need to promote and work with schools to develop mentoring programs and really starting with young people at a young age to work on conflict resolution and really just how to manage their anger.
That's right down the pike of the church, that kind of training, it sounds like. What else do you have in mind?
I think especially in the urban core, there's this culture of not snitching. And I think the church has to really speak out against that. That it's really not snitching. You're really just sharing information. I don't know if this presents sort of the mentality that, well, nobody's going to tell so I can get away with it. But I really do think churches have to say something about this no snitch culture that we see in our urban core.
You know, Reverend Anderson, your church, as I mentioned, is out in Overland Park. Why are you concerned about this issue at all? Because Overland Park doesn't have nearly the crime issue that the inner city of Kansas City does.
Well, I think it's a couple of things. One is this idea of silence, and silence is compliance. And we see a lot of memes, Facebook and social media, about thoughts and prayers are not going to take us much further. But indeed, prayer is the foundation of the church, but it's prayer with action, and not to be fearful to the point that silence is the conversation, because silence is saying something. And I think that is the danger of the suburban church.
So you're saying something. What is your church doing?
The church itself is in dialogue. Being a mainlined church, we have a lot of resolutions and papers, and we like to study and have committees. So it's those things, but trying to move forward, as Reverend Cleaver said, moving into some action. And we're not quite at that point. We're actually probably to push back the silence piece and let's have conversations.
How tough of a job is it to sell your congregation and your congregants on the idea that this city has a crisis on its hand and is struggling every day to deal with it?
that's a broad-based question, but I think part of it is when we talk about gun violence, too often people associate it with gun control, and they can be separate issues. So understanding that gun violence affects all of us, whether we're part of the numbers or not, we take action.
You know, Reverend Cleaver, it goes without saying that this problem has been going on for a long time, and there have been concerns in town that a lot of people have simply become numb to it. And I'm wondering, how do you work to counter that idea at St. James?
I mean, yeah, you hear so much about it that you can sort of pass by without, you know, thinking twice when you hear about all the violence unless it affects you. Well, one thing, you know, we constantly talk about it when there are things that come up in the community. I think it has to be talked about from the pulpit to let people know this is not something that we can ignore, not something that we can think, well, if it doesn't affect or impact my family directly, I don't have to worry about it. So just keeping it in front of the people constantly to say that, you know, we are the eyes, the ears, the hands of God in the world today, and it's really up to us to do something about it.
I'm just curious, to what extent are at least some members of your church, Reverend Cleaver, are they simply scared by what's been going on not only here in town lately, but across the country?
I think there is a lot of worry and great concern because, you know, some of the violence really hits close to home. And yes, there are some who are afraid and some who really want to do something about it. And so there are all sorts of organizations, nonprofit groups who are really involved in this. And so just encouraging people to get involved with some of those groups. I don't think the church should try to come up with the solution itself. There are so many groups already working, and I think churches really need to partner with those groups.
I was going to say, to what extent are the churches partnering with those groups and partnering with other churches to move the pendulum here a little bit?
I think it's happening. There needs to be a lot more of it. Actually, this evening at St. James, we're having an event. It's called the State of the Black Church,
right?
In recognition of 400 years of Africans in America. And that will be part of our conversation. We actually have a representative from the Kansas City, Missouri Health Department to talk about this very issue, what churches can do to really, you know, halt some of this violence that we see in Kansas City.
Is the health department looking for more help, more support from the church?
Well, there are a few initiatives. Yes, they are looking for help, but there are a few initiatives that they're going to introduce. So we have about six pastors. We've invited congregations from all over to hear this, and hopefully we'll have several that'll sign up.
I should just mention that this event that Reverend Cleaver just mentioned takes place at 7 tonight at St. James United Methodist Church's MLK campus. That's at 5540 Wayne. The public is invited. People can come and listen, right?
Absolutely, and ask questions.
Right. Reverend Anderson, to what extent are your congregants worried about this spate of mass shootings and even what's going on here in Kansas City?
Well, I think as Reverend Cleaver said, there's a variety of groups here in Kansas City, nonprofits, and many of our members are part of that. Grandparents Against Gun Violence and other community organizing groups that we band together because it can't be done alone. So I think there's not necessarily things individually that Rolling Hills is doing, but yeah, there are things that members are concerned about.
Is it difficult to figure out what a suburban church like yours can do? How do you intersect? How do you engage in a situation like this? Reverend Cleaver just said it isn't the church's responsibility to solve this issue, but to play a more supportive role in different ways.
Absolutely. I would tend to agree. And it's such a broad issue. I mean,
yes,
we go from individual shootings, metropolitan, to mass shootings. And so, you know, one of the things probably Rolling Hills has taken on is addressing in the mass shootings just because of the shootings that have happened in congregations and
yeah,
how we prepare for that. A few years ago, it was not thought of that part of our committee structure would be a safety initiative, but it's very much in response to mass shootings.
I was going to say the problem is so large and so complicated once you dive into it. As I mentioned in the opening, there are concerns about jobs and about the quality of education. There's concerns concerns about health care, all these different issues that span the sociological spectrum, for a church trying to figure out, well, where can we have some impact, it can't be an easy thing to figure out.
It's not an easy thing, so I wouldn't want to give an easy answer. But I think the church's responsibility is a recognition we are all God's children, and how are we going to come together? And not that we have solutions, but we can take action together and step by step, not to be the frozen chosen. We're going to take a step each day, and hopefully it's a step forward.
I'm wondering, this idea, you've both mentioned it here this morning, this idea of what the Bible says about the importance of taking action. Your faith calls you to action. What is the biblical undergirding for that idea? Is there a passage from the Bible that speaks directly to that?
I mean, there are probably several.
Yeah.
Jesus, when he gave a commandment, he said, love one another as I have loved you. Also what we call the Beatitudes, blessed are the peacemakers. And so I think there are several that we could use to really undergird what it is we're supposed to do in terms of spreading peace.
Yeah,
I would tend to agree. A quick image came to mind was this righteous anger, Jesus flipping over the table. So we have both. It's not one or the other. How do we have prayer? How do we hold to our scripture, our calling, the gospel, and to act?
Yeah. Reverend Cleaver, is it difficult for your congregation, which is closer to the inner city than Reverend Anderson's here, is it difficult for your church to know exactly which spots to pick where you can be helpful here?
I think there are so many ways to approach it. And there's not just one avenue. So I think in our congregation, we have several members who are involved in a number of different organizations. I think, working with schools, and one thing that we have not mentioned, mental health, which is a stigma in the urban core. And we really have to talk about how mental illness plays an issue. We have no problem going to a podiatrist if we have problems with our feet, no problem going to the dentist if we have problem with our teeth. And we have to make it not such a big deal if we need to sit down and talk with a counselor. So I think there are a number of different avenues where people can get
in. Is that stigma softening these days? Because you get a sense that that's in the society at large, that it, in fact, is to a significant degree.
I want to hope it is, but right. I can't say for sure. For many years, when people had mental health issues, they would go see their pastor or rabbi. And the reality is that most of us are not trained in that area. I tell people I can give you some spiritual advice, but if the issue is much broader than what I am trained to do, I'll recommend a mental health professional.
Yeah. The other thing that strikes me about this issue is that it can delve into politics pretty quickly, particularly when you wrap your arms around the gun control debate. We all know former Mayor Sly James was really outspoken about the need for Kansas City to rid itself of so many of the guns that are on our streets these days, and didn't get a lot of cooperation from the Missouri General Assembly. He was very critical and outspoken about that. How tricky is that for a pastor like you, Reverend Anderson, when this issue can get political so quickly?
It can be very tricky because the culture and the climate right now is to very much intertwine politics and our call to the gospel. And I think if we continue to look at the gospel as followers of Christ, what does that mean? And take the politics away, take away the liberal and progressive, the basic things like Reverend Cleaver said, to love one another and to really lean into that commandment. Hopefully that takes away the edge of some of the politics, but the reality is not. And Rolling Hills is a fairly large congregation and it has all political views. But I think some of that is the climate where we have allowed that to, frankly, steal what is our gospel truth.
At what point would would you feel comfortable, or maybe you never would feel comfortable, but just weighing in directly on a searing issue like gun control?
Would not necessarily probably take on gun control from the pulpit, but I would feel entirely comfortable addressing gun violence from the pulpit. Mm-hmm. That may seem like a fine line for folks, but I think there's a little bit of difference where control is policy and politics. Violence is addressing how we lean into our faith.
Reverend Cleaver, there's no secret you come from a political family. How do you deal with issues like that in your church and from the pulpit?
Well, you know, historically in the Black church, it is talked about those things. And so talking about gun control, I mean, would be expected in many congregations. And so at St. James, I have no problem talking about it. I do understand, you know, not every congregation is able to have that kind of conversation. But, I want to press people and push people. You can be a gun owner and still want gun control.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so I have no issue taking up and talking about some of those things. St. James is a politically active congregation, and it is and has been
and
for several years.
And you encourage that.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. You know, Oakland's program has members of the community, including clergy, doing evening walks through neighborhoods, walking up to people at risk of committing violence, reminding them that they are valued members of the community, but that the violence should stop. Do you see yourselves doing something similar? Is that a role that you've played, Reverend Cleaver?
It's something we've talked about at St. James, but really trying to understand how effective it is. I've started talking with some pastors in other urban areas, Dallas and Wichita, Kansas, to really look at what some of the congregations are doing there to really curb some of the violence. And, you know, that's something that I'm familiar with, but we have not done a whole lot of it as of yet.
Because you do get a sense that the city is at a moment of crisis here, that this thing has reached a point where you have members of the community engaging in ways they haven't before, filming cars going up and down the street, you know, actively coordinating with their neighbors. We've talked about that on this show, even in recent days. So you do get a sense that we're at a pivotal moment here, Reverend.
Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, with the information coming out about the state of Missouri, just how violent it is. And it's really, you know, St. Louis and Kansas City. So, yes, we've come to a point where something has to be done. It's, no longer just thoughts and prayers, but action has to be taken. And I think the faith community is in a perfect position to really take an active role in that.
Can you see the Black churches just to shortcut this, you know, coordinating more and even offering up joint statements to address what ministers think the road ahead should be? You guys have a very powerful voice in this community.
Yes, and I'm hoping that's something that will come out of our discussion this evening. But yes, there has been a lot of conversation, and I think that will continue. But yes, we do need a unified voice.
What's the impetus for this meeting tonight, the state of the Black church, its role in addressing violence, again, taking place at 7 o'clock tonight at St. James United Methodist, 5540 Wayne. Public is invited. What's the push behind that, this particular meeting?
Well, violence, you know, talking about what the church can do regarding violence is just part of it. Another part is really just the resiliency. We're celebrating the role that the Black church has played in terms of education, in terms of social justice, and where we're going from here.
Mm-hmm. Is this something that Kansas side ministers are taking part in tonight, Reverend Anderson?
I honestly don't know if there are folks taking part in this evening's event, but I think the importance is that if it's not tonight, let's start tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
And if folks can be there tonight, because I think it will be really important not to segregate the issue as inner city and a suburban and who's most affected, but what can we do together? So
and that you just pinpoint it. That's one of the big challenges here, right? There's what the Kansas City Health Department will say is that violence is like a disease and it spreads throughout an organism like the entire metropolitan community. It's a problem for all of us. And yet you feel anything west of State Line Road or even further to the east, there's not a whole lot of engagement here.
Exactly. So, you know, if that's our first step of action is in joining and making sure that just if it's not happening in our specific neighborhood, it is our city, it is our brothers and sisters, and how do we come together?
Okay. Again, that meeting tonight at 7 at St. James United Methodist Church, 5540 Wayne. The public's invited. The topic, the state of the Black Church and its role in addressing violence. I want to thank the Reverend Dr. Emmanuel Cleaver III, Senior Pastor of St. James United Methodist Church in Kansas City. We were joined also by the Reverend Lori Anderson from Rolling Hills Presbyterian Church in Overland Park. Thank you both very much. Appreciate
it. Thank you.
Time for a break. When we come back, we'll address the question of whether Kansas City has a toxic driving culture. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we are back. I'm Steve Kraske. Before the week is over, make sure you sign up to get my weekly newsletter in your inbox next Monday. Go to kcur.org/Kraske. You'll read exclusive insights from me and highlights from the up-to-date team. Just go to kcur.org/Kraske. Tomorrow on the show, our film critics are back. We'll get their reviews of the movies that you should kick your feet up and watch this weekend. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up-to-Date. Well, Councilman Eric Bunch is tweeting this week that Kansas City has a toxic driving culture. He was referring to an incident that apparently took place on Tuesday when Bunch was trying to cross a street at a marked crosswalk. He wrote this, "A driver swerved away and then back at me. I reflexively put out my hands, hit the mirror in defense. Driver got out, hit me in the face with a lighter, shouted expletives." He ended by saying, "We have a toxic driving culture." That set off a long string of tweets with many posters agreeing with him. Here's one. "There's something about cars that turns people into psychopaths." Here's another. "Drivers dehumanize pedestrians and they personify cars." And a third. "My brain has blocked out the potential of any alternative than to be in constant fear of being run down." So what rights do pedestrians have in our car-crazy society? Who has the right of way? And is Kansas City getting any safer for pedestrians and bicyclists? What's here to talk about it are Brent Hugh. He's Executive Director of Missouri Bicycle and the Pedestrian Federation. Brent, nice to have you. Welcome.
Glad to be here.
Eric Rogers is Executive Director and co-founder of Bike Walk KC. Eric, good morning to you.
Good morning, Steve.
You know, I can't help but wonder, Brent, how surprised are you about what happened to Councilman Bunch this week?
Well, not too surprised. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've actually
this is
had
familiar,
an experience
right?
similar to that when I was on my bike. But the flip side is you have to remember that does happen, like happened to me about 12 years ago. So, you know, it's not 20% of drivers who have this kind of problem. It's probably not 5%. It's probably not even 1%. Or every time you'd be on the street, you'd be right. harassed and have a lighter thrown at you. It's maybe 1 in 1,000 or 1 in 10,000. But the trouble is when you're out biking, walking, you're going to see 500, 1,000 people a day.
Yeah, so. Yeah. Eric, do you view it the same way? Is the problem fairly confined to a small group out there?
I think it really depends on where you're at, what part of town you're in, and how often you are out on the streets. Mm-hmm. You know, the more you are a pedestrian or a cyclist, the more frequently this does happen to you, especially those folks who rely on walking or biking to get where they're going, don't have the luxury of being in a car. It really does matter. And it's even more than just a toxic culture. It's an entire system that is set up to prioritize cars over people. From the way that our streets are physically designed and built all the way up to the policies at City Hall and State Capitals.
I thought that's supposed to be changing. We're doing bike lanes. We're talking about, you know, making our city more pedestrian friendly. Aren't we in a new era here?
We're at the beginning of a new era. We have a long way to go.
Yeah.
Kansas City has been far behind on these issues for many years. And so while there is progress happening. We still have a long way to go, even to get up to average.
Why is Kansas City behind? You hear this all the time, that we're not the same as a Denver or, you know, other cities. What's the deal?
Well, the big thing is I have an interesting story. I went on study abroad in Vienna 35 years ago now. At that time, they were like Kansas City, very unfriendly biking and walking, but that's when they were at the beginning. This was in 1983.
Mm-hmm.
So they started in 1983. My sister and I went back to visit the city a couple of years ago. I mean, it was transformed. People were biking, walking. It was a completely different place. I was astonished, but the big difference is, honestly, they started in 1980, and they've been working at it diligently from that time. A lot of our American cities started maybe about 2000. Mm-hmm. They're that far ahead of us. We really didn't. I'd say the ground zero was when the BBC came here in 2007 and said, Kansas City is the worst bicycling city in the U.S. What is it like to live here? And I know we all had a big response to that.
So when you say cities have to work on this, Brent, what does that mean? What are the steps that need to be taken to make this city more friendly to pedestrians and bikers?
Well, the good news is, as Eric said, we've done some of the initial steps. We've got a good plan in place. There's a pedestrian plan adopted. There's a bike plan waiting for the city council to take action on it now. They really should move that forward as quickly as possible.
Yeah.
They've started to put some bike lanes, some trails around the city. You know, they have improved. I just went through campus today, like Main Street through UMKC is a lot better than it was when I went to UMKC in the 90s.
Right.
Troost, on the other hand, looks about the same, just as bad.
Mm-hmm.
So we've taken those initial steps, but now we've really got to follow through. And what you've got to do in the big picture, you've got to slow down traffic. You've got to make every street where people are going to be really inviting to bike and walk there and safe.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a really thoroughgoing, different way of looking how you view a city and how you view the city streets. They're not just for cars. They're places where people come, walk, bike, use all different transportation modes. Cities are for people. Streets are for people.
You know, Eric, with Bike Walk KC, is Kansas City, does it have that mindset now? Are you convinced that we've turned the corner?
I think we're approaching the corner. I don't think we've turned it yet. I think we still have a lot of work to do. We really need changes in public policy to prioritize these things.
Yeah.
We talk about something called Vision Zero, which is a national movement to get towards zero traffic fatalities. You know, it's really interesting. There's a lot of talk in Kansas City, I think even on your program earlier today, about gun violence and the epidemic of gun violence. If you look at the national stats, the number of people that are killed in traffic crashes equal the number of homicides due to guns. But we don't talk about traffic fatalities with the same sense of urgency. And so something like Vision Zero sets out the goal that there shouldn't be any traffic death. And it really tackles this problem from a public health perspective, looks at it from the lens of epidemiology, and really looks at the system and how the system is broken and how that can be fixed.
The question on the table, does Kansas City have a toxic driving culture? City Councilman Eric Bunch has had a bad experience. He thinks it does. Our number, 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. Let's go to some phone calls here and find out what Kansas Cityans are thinking about this. Ashley from Kansas City, Missouri, good morning.
Good morning.
Go ahead, Ashley.
Oh, hi. Well, I was just going to quickly say that we our family has a couple of issues that go in line with this. One, our kids go to a school at the intersection of Broadway and Armour, and a lot of the students at our school walk and bike to school, and we've had lots of issues. We're working with people to try and get that fixed, but a lot of it has to do with people fly down Broadway. People don't pay attention to the signs that say no turn on red, and we need like school zone signs there. And then the other problem that we have is that in our neighborhood, there are lots of streets. We live in Waldo. There are lots of streets that don't even have sidewalks. And so that's an issue too. And it feels like the city doesn't pay a whole lot of attention to that at this point.
Is that going to change, Ashley, this lack of sidewalks? Is that going to change in the Armour Hills neighborhood?
I hope so.
Yeah.
I would hope so. I mean, the school, it's only 4 years old, and it's a charter, and there wasn't anything there before aside from businesses and a lot of, like, closed-off buildings. So it's kind of being revamped, but it's just, it takes a lot of work and effort. It feels like one of those things that kind of gets put off to the side in terms of, you know, people talk about snow removal and things like that,
right?
Which, I mean, that's a safety issue too, but I feel like walking and biking is more all year round issue, and it doesn't really get talked about a lot.
Ashley, thank you for those comments. Eric?
Yes. I absolutely am familiar with the issues Ashley's talking about in that particular location. At Bike Walk KC, we work with 20 to 30 schools every semester on safe routes to school, which is helping kids walk and bike to school. And it is a struggle for a lot of those reasons. There is a little bit of progress to point to with the sidewalks in particular. You know, a couple of years ago, the city auditor identified that Kansas City has a $1 billion backlog to bring all the sidewalks into good repair and add sidewalks to neighborhoods where they don't exist. A couple of years ago, we had this big infrastructure bond that the citizens approved at the ballot, and that includes $150 million for sidewalks specifically to start tackling this issue. I mean, it doesn't get us towards $1 billion, but it is a step in the right direction. It's $150 million over 20 years. So, you know, this is a problem that we've spent the last 50 years getting ourselves into. It's going to take a long time to get out of.
You know, what I want to drive at here, Brent, one Twitter response to Councilman Bunch mentioned that drivers dehumanize pedestrians and they personify cars. Interesting comment. I think there's something to that.
Yeah, and then again, sort of not saying that people get in their car and just want to be, you know, dangerous or hurt someone, but there is, I think,
it's a different attitude when you're in a car and you're surrounded, you're protected, and a pedestrian's exposed, and you feel there's a power differential.
Yeah,
there.
You're isolated. You're isolated from the other people, and I have to say, one reason we talk about to be a great city, you need to be friendly for biking and walking. People want to live in a place that's a great place to walk and bike. And one reason is because we see that human connection. When you're walking down the street and you see someone, look someone in the eye, you're riding your bike, you stop at the traffic light with them, you can have even a little chat.
Right.
When was the last time you had a little chat with someone when you pulled up in your car? It's just a very isolating experience.
Let's go back to some calls here. Ted from Kansas City, Missouri. Ted, you're on Up to Date. We're talking about if Kansas City has a toxic driving culture. Good morning.
Yeah, I'll try to make it as quick as possible. One, I think that one of the biggest problems in the city is that our traffic light system is archaic. And it wastes a lot of time, and I think it agitates people. I've sat at more red lights watching nothing go by in this city than any city I've ever lived in, and I've lived all over the country. And the other thing is, and we have a horrible carbon footprint for it. The other thing is that this is the rudest driving style I've ever encountered, and I have lived all over the country. People here, once they get in their car, they do not care about anyone, not just pedestrians, but other drivers. I've never seen a city where so many people went into the cruising lane, which is supposed to be for faster vehicles, under the speed limit and thinking they're just fine to be there. It's okay because they're the only ones that are out there. My joke, and I'll end this with this comment to some of my friends here because I'm not from here, is that there are lots of people in Kansas City that should never be issued rearview mirrors because they never look behind them. They don't care what's happening behind them.
Right. That's an interesting comment Ted makes about traffic signals being a source of agitation. Does that make sense?
Well, we certainly do have a lot of old signals, and I can tell you from being on some of these committees, this is where it goes. So why does it take years to really address this? You know, to update a traffic signal is going to be somewhere in the range of 200 to 300,000 to bring it up with modern controllers and, you know, maybe synchronize.
I mean, that's a lot of money, but that sounds like a manageable amount of money, or am I wrong?
Well, no, it is, but, you know, then multiply that by every traffic light in the city. And
oh, it's for every traffic. Every traffic light, $200,000?
Well, every one you update, yeah. If you take one that's say 20 years old and bring it up to a modern system,
that's $200,000.
Yes, $200 to $300 is what I would remember seeing for them. It's surprisingly a lot. People don't realize how much transportation costs.
I had no idea
how much investment we have in it.
Bulbs in a box. How can they cost $200,000?
A freeway interchange is going to be $40 to $50 million minimum. So that's when we talk about, hey, we're going to invest $40 or $50 million in bicycling. I mean, if you talk to transportation engineers, this is like the greatest bargain they've ever seen. It's got better bang for the buck than any other thing you can do. But people don't realize, I mean, some houses probably have more investment in the street and all that infrastructure in front of their house than the house costs. It's a lot.
Eric, help me understand why it costs $200,000 to change a traffic signal.
They're computerized. They're linked to each other and networked. Yeah. And so it's not just that one signal, but it's how does that signal affect all of the ones around it before and after and on the side streets. So another alternative you could use that is a more efficient use of resources a lot of times is to design the streets so you don't need the traffic lights. Design the streets so that it is slower, that there's more priority given to cyclists and pedestrians. Mm-hmm. And it's really about a street that functions as public space for the neighborhood where it is, and not as much as a pass-through for people from outside of the neighborhood.
That's interesting. Yeah.
One of the things, yeah, if you design a street so you can just say go 25 miles an hour steady, drivers actually enjoy that experience more than, oh, I'm going 40,
that. Yeah. Mike from Roland Park. Mike, you're on Up to Date.
Yeah, I just had a quick comment to make. I was recently at one of the Shawnee Mission parks and walking my dogs, and with them on leash, I have to say that for the first time I felt unsafe because of the rudeness of the bicyclists. They don't tell you whether they're approaching, whether they're in front of you or behind you. They seem to think that they have the freedom of the road and can ride as fast as they want to without any respect for the pedestrians, and I'm shocked, just shocked. And
so now we find out that the bicyclists themselves are also rude. Is anybody friendly out there anymore, Eric? Yeah.
I would like to think so. You know, we're all humans, and so there are people on bikes who are rude at just the same rate that people in cars are rude. It happens to all of us at one point or another. And I think particularly in Shawnee Mission at the park there, what you see is there's such a demand for the trails that there isn't enough room for everybody. And so you're taking a huge demand for places to walk and bike and constraining it into a very small supply of facilities. And so to me, that's a sign that there aren't enough places for people to be out.
Well, it is tricky these days because every once in a while you find yourself on the sidewalk because you're too nervous to ride in the street, which is what I do. And, you know, a lot of people have these earbuds and they can't hear you coming. And there's just an inherent lots of conflict there.
But just to make a couple of things clear, if you are passing a pedestrian on a trail, you do need to let them know you're coming.
Yes.
And back to the very first, if a pedestrian's in a crosswalk, the cars must stop. That's state law, city law. You know, so some of it is,
and
we need
good
to
luck with that in Kansas City. You're taking your life in your hands.
Expectation, because it's the law.
Okay, we'll have to leave our conversation there. That was the voice of Brent Hugh, Executive Director of the Missouri Bicycle and Pedestrian Federation. Eric Rogers also joined us. He's Executive Director and co-founder of Bike Walk KC. Gentlemen, thank you very much. Sure, appreciate it.
Thank you, Steve.
Enjoyed it.
Coming up, we'll talk about some cool stuff to do this weekend with Spencer Hardwick and Brian McTavish. Well, look who's in the house here to talk about some fun stuff to do this weekend. Spencer Hardwick, founder and curator of Wire KC Weekender, and Brian McTavish talk about some fun stuff to do this weekend. Gentlemen, how are we? Yeah.
I think we're super cool.
Cool.
And even better with this music.
I was going to say, it's very cool because that's Charlie Parker, and we're talking about him because why, Spencer?
Absolutely. Kansas City icon Charlie Parker, his 99th birthday is coming up, and to celebrate, the Mutual Musicians Foundation and Jackson County Historical Society are pairing together for a night and a birthday bash on Saturday, August 24th at 6 p.m. So there'll be music, jazz, fun, food, and of course, really great jazz performances from all across the city. It's going to be a time to remember.
You know, the really sad thing is he died back in 1955, before I was born, believe it or not. Would have loved to have heard him play once.
Yes,
you know, just to listen to what we just heard.
Well,
just amazing.
The Mutual Musicians Foundation is one of the places where you can really hear the sound of Bird and other great jazz artists from now, from past to present. And so that can be a great place where they're paying homage, paying legacy. So go and check that out. You can hear all about it.
And even in the future, if you go to the foundation, if you show up, they have these all-night jam sessions.
Yes. So that's
starts about 2 a.m., which is a bit of a stretch for me, but not for a guy like you.
One of the best kept secrets in Kansas City. Definitely check out Mutual Musicians Foundation.
All right.
Of course I can dance. Of course I can dance. I'm sure I can dance. I'm sure I can dance. I can dance. I can dance. I really hit the floor. Oh, it feels good. Let me dance
it. Let's talk about dancing, Mr. McTavish. Why are we talking about dancing?
Well, all right,
I'm speaking
Mr.
to one
Kraske.
Of the great dancers that Kansas City's ever seen in
Spencer?
Brian McTavish.
Is that Spencer?
That's you.
Oh,
I've seen you cut it.
Actually, I'm not sure you really have.
That may be
uh-oh.
True.
No, not really. Where it all goes crazy.
Yes.
I just start moving like a super long string of spaghetti.
Crazy.
There's a lot of movement, a lot of height there to move around.
No way to really describe it appropriately. So, it's KC Dance Day, sponsored by the Kansas City Ballet. Kansas City Ballet hosts a full day, a completely full day of free dance classes and performances. It gets going 9:15 in the morning. It goes all the way till 6 o'clock in the early evening Saturday at the Todd Bolander Center, just west
free
of
dance classes,
Union
I
Station.
Should point out.
Absolutely. Free dance classes. Let's talk briefly. And free performances, including an open rehearsal by the Kansas City Ballet Company, okay?
Mm-hmm.
It's such a full day that you can eat in. They have a $7 lunch.
Oh, excellent.
Whether you want a real hamburger or a veggie burger.
Mm-hmm.
And if you want something else, bring your own. But 45-minute classes... Free classes, ages 2 to 12 and ages 12 and older, all skill levels welcome, whether it's ballet, jazz, hip-hop, something called Dance a Story for the
wee ones. Those classes would really fill up if you were one of the participants in the class, and we advertised that fact. People would come watch you dance. I would come watch you. I'd pay money to come watch you
crazy
dance.
Crazy Legs class.
We should mention this to the Kansas City Ballet. They might schedule me next year.
Okay.
But youth dance performances, all sorts of, and some of the best dance groups in town. Check it out. If Leo Sayer can dance, you can dance.
Okay. Let's move on to our next item here, Spencer. This is Coloring Within the Lines, a play from Michelle Tyrene Johnson, who's one of our staffers here at KCUR.
Absolutely. Michelle does double time. She's a Kansas City playwright, and she reports on race, identity, and culture here at KCUR. She is directing and putting on a play at the Nelson called Coloring Within the Lines. And have you heard of the 30 Americans exhibit?
I have heard it. It's about to close.
It's about to close on the 25th. What an excellent way to punctuate one of the premier art exhibits in the city. 30 Americans exhibit is about 30 African-American artists and some very thought-provoking, powerful, and can be really impactful pieces at the Nelson Atkins Museum. And so this play helps to bring those different pieces to life. So I'm definitely going to try to be there. If you are a fan of the 30 Americans Museum or you're curious about the 30 Americans Museum, this is an excellent way to learn more about it and get those pieces to come to life.
Well, you're describing my Friday night to me. I'm going to go before the play and see the 30 Americans exhibit, then go see Michelle's play, and I'm looking forward to it.
Absolutely. And I want to drop a quick piece here. There's a quick interview done by Rock Hushka, the chief curator of the Tacoma Art Museum. He's going to talk a little bit about the impact of this play's exhibition.
Given the current political season where race has been foregrounded, an exhibition like 30 Americans can help us begin to have some of these really complicated conversations about race, identity, and experience.
You know, I've heard nothing but good things about 30 Americans. It's worth going to check out before it leaves.
Absolutely. And I think one of the more powerful things it's done, it's caused a lot of conversation in the friends who've gone to the exhibit and who I've attended the exhibit with. So more than just the art, it's about the conversations that you're having afterward. That's why I tip my cap to Michelle.
Okay. You know, always like this song. always. You just can't. You can't sit still to that.
Well,
you just start moving all over the place.
I think clearly the thing to do is to play it every week.
Yeah, it should become our theme song.
And Spencer and I are very flexible. We can just come up with something where it's vaguely appropriate.
That would be helpful.
Start a new dance class.
Yeah, there you go.
Oh, you came back. That's nice.
Ideas.
Very good. So, but this is actually highly appropriate because low riders, those hydraulically activated cars that hop up and down, yes. Well, those are works of art, among other things, and they're part of the Kemper Museum of Contemporary Arts Block Party. It's the 5th annual summer block party. It's also in celebration of the Kemper Museum's 25th anniversary. So, in brief, you can check out 4 galleries of some of the Kemper's permanent collection on display, lawn games outside, face painting, art making of all sorts for all ages. You can even trundle across the street and check out the Kansas City Art Institute's ceramics department for live art making demonstrations.
Right.
Modern soul band Hilux will be there, food trucks. You can create a collage. You can do lots of things.
See you later, alligator.
Okay, let's talk alligators. What are we talking about here, Spencer?
Well, Steve, first a question. Do you remember Steve Irwin?
I do.
The crocodile hunter.
Crocodile hunter.
Grew up listening.
Love Steve Irwin.
I used to be a teacher, and I actually introduced Steve Irwin to my students, and they were just transfixed on him wrestling alligators and crocodiles and teaching us about wildlife.
Yeah.
You have a chance this weekend to learn about exotic reptiles at the Exotic Reptile Show, one of the largest reptile exhibits in the state of Missouri. Amphibians, inverts, there'll be feeders, small animals. Of course, there'll be food, but if this is the chance, if you want a pet iguana, if you want a large python, this is the place to do it. It'll be on Friday, 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. at 51st and Ararat Drive.
Okay, and finally today.
70 miles an hour down a gravel road. Crank down the wind to get the paper throwed. Don't hit the flowers. Read all about it in the wee hours. We're front page news. We're the big headlines. We're coming to your town. We're the Kansas City Times.
I recognize that group.
Oh, yeah.
They're local boys, and they're good.
Oh, yeah. That's
the Rainmakers.
Rainmakers frontman Bob Walkenhorst performing a little ditty about throwing that local morning paper that no longer exists.
That's
no more
right.
Kansas City Times.
That's
gosh.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, Rainmakers are the headliners on Saturday night of the all-weekend-long Tiblo Days. That's the 40th annual Community Heritage Festival in Bonner Springs. It includes a carnival, a parade, and I did mention the Rainmakers. Rainmakers, real quick, who are the Rainmakers? We know who they are.
Yeah, we know who they are.
But somebody out there might not know, and you should check them out. They're the late 1980s and early 90s KC band that they'd go on to make MTV videos. They had what I vaguely recall was a fashion spread in Rolling Stone magazine. Yeah. That was a big deal at the time. And they've become a perennial favorite in Norway. They just performed their See You Later Norway final concert there this summer.
Wow.
No one knows why they're big in Norway.
But they're playing this weekend.
They're big in Bonner Springs. They're playing Saturday night in Bonner Springs. Check them out.
That's Brian McTavish and Spencer Hardwick with your weekend to-do list. Gentlemen, thank you very much. Appreciate
thank you.
It.
Thank you.
Tomorrow, if you need a reason to get out of this muggy weather, our film critics are back with just a solution. Hear their reviews of the indie documentary and foreign films you should see. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.